You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora koutou and welcome to The Wire for Friday the 10th of November. Ko Kelly Enright tōku ingoa. I'm joined in studio by my producers Laura Quigstad and Connor Mercer. How are we going, guys?
Great to be here, Kelly.
Yeah, it's been a busy morning. We've had a lot of coffee, but we're here and we've got the news for you. So first up, producer Connor speaks with Professor Jane Kelsey of the University of Auckland Law School for an update on how the TPPA negotiations are unfolding. Next up, we have Te Rōpū Ngā Hinara National Party MP Jamie Lee Ross joining us live for our weekly political chat. Then producer Laura talks with Rail and Maritime Transport Union spokesperson John Kerr about a protest and petition that's happening this evening. Following that, of course, we chat with Nicole Wedding from Radio Adelaide and Neighbourhood Watch. And after that, Laura talks with the sustainability manager at Reclaim, Peter Ralph, about Recycling Week and the efforts to raise awareness around the importance of recycling. Now, if you've got anything to add or anything you want to talk to us about, tuku patuhi mai, give us a text on 5395 or wire mai, call us 309 3879.
Wire. Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That's right. Earlier I spoke with Professor Jane Kelsey of the University of Auckland Law Department. We caught up over the TPPA and I started by asking Jane what's happened over the last week and if she could explain a little bit of the controversy developing between Japan and Canada.
A week before these meetings in Vietnam, there were some meetings in Japan to try to finalise what the 11 countries without the US would do. And they had 50 items on the agenda there. And they were looking at suspending those items from the agreement pending the US re-entering if and when it ever did. There were some small items and a number of things that were agreed to and a number that weren't that then got deferred for the officials to discuss further in Vietnam. They didn't reach a conclusion despite various late-night meetings and it got kicked on to the ministers. Japan has been the one that has been pushing super hard to get a deal, largely because Prime Minister Abe has spent so much political capital on this. But in some areas, he's also acting, ironically, as a proxy for the US, for example, in relation to intellectual property, which the pharmaceutical industries and so on in the US still want to benefit from, even if they're not in the deal. Then there was some announcements that came out late last night from the Japanese trade minister and the Mexican one reported in the media that they had reached an agreement in principle. And indeed, even in the Japanese one said that they would have a signing in Japan in January. And then the Canadian trade minister tweeted, "No, we haven't." And so I think what we've got is a classic exercise of Japan's brinkmanship in trying to push ministers into accepting what Japan has been demanding, which is an outcome with minimal changes, and the Canadians have stood up to them.
What are some of the issues that Canada might be finding prominent with the agreement currently, to the point where they're wanting to go out there and publicly say, no, we have not reached an agreement?
Canada has some quite unique issues. It has some concerns around culture, in particular in relation to films and music and broadcasting and so on. And the US, on behalf of Hollywood and the likes, has always resisted those being in the agreements. And so that's one thing Canada's been after. It also has some sensitive issues in the way that it runs some of its agriculture, dairy and poultry, for example, and it's been wanting changes on that. And it's been wanting a number of other things that, because it's engaged in a renegotiation of another agreement known as NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, with Trump and Mexico, it's wanting to kind of cover its bases and not give stuff away in TPPA that it might want to protect in NAFTA. So there's a bit of a chess game there as well. But the important thing is, just like in New Zealand, you had a new government, the Trudeau government, that wasn't the one that negotiated the original deal. And they are saying we need the time, the opportunity and the right to go back as a new government and look at this again to see what is important in our national interest.
Is it realistic to think that 10, 11 or more or so countries can have an agreement of this nature when they run domestic institutions which change every 3 to 4 or 5 years depending on their term? Because just in the process of negotiation, we've seen America pull out, we've seen sort of small turnarounds from New Zealand and Canadian governments, and we're seeing places like Japan really trying to push it from a government that has been in power through the negotiation process. Is it realistic to think that if something was signed, it could actually sustain through the future?
Well, that's the whole purpose of the agreements. The purpose of the agreements is to put handcuffs on governments so that when governments change, albeit with a democratic mandate to do something different, they're pre-committed to maintaining a certain position and that they can suffer either economic sanctions in terms of changing trade rules or financial penalties and damages in the case of foreign investors suing them. That's the whole purpose of this. And so there is a fundamental collision between democracy and the purpose of these agreements, especially when they're conducted in secret. But there's also a fundamental collision between notions of sovereignty, and that one government now can't bind a government of the future, and that states are sovereign to decide their own future direction, and agreements that are designed to remove very significant parts of the autonomy of sovereign states.
Looking at New Zealand, we have seen protests and marches over the last several years about the TPPA. Is this a trend across the countries involved in the agreement, or is this unique to somewhere like New Zealand where it represents part of our culture to be quite active and involved in these sort of things?
There are very different countries involved here. There have been protests in Japan, but Japanese politics is very different from here. In Canada, there has been deep concern, but they've had three of these mega deals that they've been dealing with, one with the EU, now the review of NAFTA plus the TPPA. In Australia, they have a really serious issue there because the Australian Labor Party does not support the TPPA, and they haven't been able to get it through the Senate. And there's a really serious question of whether they will be able to again. In that case, there hasn't been the mass protests that we had here, but there's been a very strong political resistance to the terms of the deal. But if you look much broader around the world, you can see that these kinds of hyper-ambitious deals, we call them mega agreements, are running into trouble because they're so audacious, they're so unbalanced, and they're coming at a time when there is this real resistance, especially after the global financial crisis, to the unbalanced kind of economy and society we have. One really good thing a couple of days ago was that the new Trade Minister, David Parker, himself said, we have to stop just pursuing these agreements for the sake of them and notches in the belt, which was the national government's approach, and we need to think about how these agreements fit within a sustainable economic development model where you deal with these questions of inequality and you deal with climate change and so on. And that's really promising. The problem will be that they will have signed away a lot of the ability to do that if they proceed.
Finally, I just wanted to pick up on that idea of the motivations for why we are pursuing these kind of mass multinational agreements. Talking about the Japanese leader Shinzo Abe, he has spent a lot of political capital on this, like you said, and he has lost a lot of political legitimacy in the last couple of years, especially with his wife being involved in the controversy over the schoolhouse, and he has dropped in the polls a lot. Do you think with the United States pulling out of this deal, he is actively seeking to take the reins as the leader in this and sort of regain a little bit of legitimacy for himself rather than for pursuing it out of genuine interest in free trade and raising up the standard of all these states?
Yeah, I think it is very much a political rather than an economic strategy on behalf of Abe. And indeed, immediately after the US pulled out, Abe said, there is no point in proceeding with this without the US. And then he's done a kind of a recalculation. Part of it is this argument that this provides a bulwark against China. And there are, of course, the big tensions between Japan and China, especially in the maritime arena. And so it's not so much cement cementing Japan's leadership, although he will probably see it that way, but it's also about neutralizing the potential dominance of China in the region. And I think that's actually a rather crude perception, but you saw the Australian Prime Minister running the same line about 3 days ago, which is a bit of a problem for Australia and New Zealand because we're so dependent on the China market as well. So Abe is undoubtedly looking at this as a way that he can assert Japan's international relevance. We understand he's been having behind the scenes discussions with the US Trade Representative's office about the things that the US really does want to make sure is in there, and which they can probably get the benefit of without actually having to pay any price for it. But Japan has also been extremely aggressive throughout these negotiations, equally aggressive in the parallel negotiations for the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. It's a worry when you have foreign policy that is being bought through agreements that affect things like the price to medicines and the ability to deal with climate change and so on.
So potentially we're seeing a modern form of realpolitik playing itself out through liberally covered ideas, I suppose is what I'd call it.
Yes, I think we have moved away from any pretense that this is actually about free trade. Of course, for the TPPA, there's only about five or six of the 30 chapters that are about old-fashioned commodity trade. It's much more about rules that are going to promote the commercial interests of various players and about clubs of countries forming like-minded coalitions in a pretty turbulent world.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Kei te whakaronga koe ki te Wire. That was Jane Kelsey. And next up is, of course, Jamie Lee Ross from the National Party. He aha o whakaoro. What are your thoughts? 5395 is the number to text if you feel like telling me.
Roll up, roll up. It's only a bloody first Thursday night at the circus. Thursday, December 7th, all along K Road.
Circuses, all spandex, acrobatics and joyous laughter, right? Well, K-Road's a bit more wild than that. Devious clowns, Burning Man-style antics, Slinky Minx dancers, Zoltar the fortune teller, and all the usual music, fashion, markets, installations, workshops and live performances. Plus, it's pet-friendly. So grab your dog and come be part of the collaboration. First Thursday, night at the circus, Thursday, December 7th, K-Road.
They will all get sick and die. Bob will die, Kim will die, your wife will die. Understand?
No, I don't.
95BFM presents The Killing of a Sacred Deer, thanks to Madman and The Vic, Wednesday, November 15th at The Vic, Devonport. Want to see the latest film from the dark and surreal mind of the lobsters Yorgos Yanthimos, but missed out on our ticket giveaway? Limited tickets to our preview screening are available now from The Vic. The Killing of a Sacred Deer preview screening, Wednesday, November 15th at The Vic, Devonport.
You do realize, Stephen, we're in this situation because of you.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so 20th century. BFM's best shows, features and interviews are now available as podcasts on RSS and Apple. Yours to cherish forever.
Welcome to 95BFM Top 10. Yours, Pearl.
Fashion. Two to the left.
On Land of the Wood Groove. Got lined up three songs.
Yo, welcome back. It's True School.
The Wire.
I don't know.
Well, you're kind of a mellow beginning to the journey.
Welcome to the Saturday 2 to 4. My name is Sarah.
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection and it's just gone.
Never miss out again. Becasts, available now on Apple Podcasts or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
It's time for our weekly political chat with the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Kia ora, Jamie. How are you today?
Hey, Kelly. Doing well.
Doing well. How has the first week of Parliament been?
Oh, it was a bit different from normal.
Yeah.
National Party, we're pretty good at counting our numbers. The new government, they've got a bit of room for improvement. Maybe a C or a B minus, you know.
Right, awesome.
But hey.
So you're the new grade teacher, eh?
Well, national standards are being abolished apparently, so someone's going to fill the gap.
Fair enough. So what has occurred this week that is positive and negative for National?
Oh, look, I think one of the positives that we're seeing for the National Party is that we're prepared to do our job in New Zealand's constitutional framework of holding the government to account. I realise that when people see Parliament going and a bit of argy-bargy or disagreements, they'll think it's just politicians being politicians. But, you know, the reality is you have a government and you have an opposition, and when governments are spending taxpayer money, making laws, they need an organisation there to hold them to account, and that's what the National Party's been doing. So there's going to be more National MPs on select committees working hard, doing their job. There's going to be more people focused on watching the government and what they're doing, and that's important in the democracy, that we're doing a good job of that.
Do you think that being that sort of challenging opposition kind of promotes strength and innovation, or can it kind of prohibit growth in terms of just sort of stopping things from getting done?
Well, Parliament can legislate for good or bad reasons, and it's important that there's people sitting there scrutinising what's going on. In a democracy, you never just want to accept the word of the government. You need to have checks and balances, and one of those checks and balances is the legislature. And the National Party, being 56 seats out of 120, we're pretty big, pretty strong, and we're going to be, as Labor did many, many times during their 9 years in opposition, we're going to exert our might and show the government that we're here to hold them to account, and that's what we're doing. But throughout the 3 years that we are in opposition, our job is to also come up with a new policy, to come up with new ideas, so that when we come to the next election, we have a new suite of policies and proposals that we can put forward to the public. And you can develop that through the parliamentary process as well, through select committees, where you're inquiring into what's happening on particular subject areas. We now will be holding the chair role on three subject select committees, so that will enable the National Party to play a role in policy development as well. And I think Labor is quite genuine when they say they want the Parliament to be an MMP Parliament, where it's not just one party controlling everything. They do want to see more contribution from other parties. So we'd like to hold them to that, and we'd like to play a part in the process.
So in terms of that, you know, talking about legislation going through, Labor has had, obviously in their first couple of weeks, some urgent policies that have gone straight to Cabinet because, you know, those Cabinet committees haven't quite been established yet. But National is saying that is, you know, that can be quite dangerous in terms of taking that stuff straight to Cabinet, and it hasn't maybe had the expert input that it needs.
That is important. You must remember, when political parties go into an election, they put forward some ideas to the public. But the amount of detail and work that's gone into those policies for an election, it's nowhere near the type of work that you need to have gone into something for it to actually become a policy of the government, become a law, and actually be put in place where it impacts on people's lives. You know, the amount of time and effort that goes into an election policy versus an act of parliament, say, an election policy, it's minute, the detail that's involved there compared to what the army of bureaucrats and officials put into a piece of legislation. And it's vital that you do have that scrutiny and you do have that work done up front, because you're making a law for the whole country. And so the argument we've put forward is to say, if the Labor Party is going to have a number of things they want to implement, it is important it goes through a proper Cabinet committee process. That's where officials and ministers sit there. They kick the tyres on things many, many times so that the policies that are being implemented are put into a shape which is appropriate for the public. And, you know, on the question time we saw yesterday, we already saw that a number of Labor's proposals that they put forward to the election, they weren't sure that it would quite work in the way that they desired a month or two ago when it was the election campaign. There's going to need to be changes. Grant Robertson said he needs to go through some budget processes with the numbers. His fiscal plan he put together may not quite fit what actually happens in government. So having that Cabinet committee process there is important for making sure laws and policies are appropriately being scrutinised, and they're getting the right advice from officials who do deal with this on a regular basis every single day.
So previously, I guess National has waited, you know, the last couple of elections, National has waited until the following year to sort of establish those Cabinet committees. Do you think that Labor should be allowed that same sort of breathing time, or do we need to see these Cabinet committees come in really soon if they're going to be passing so many new legislation?
Well, that's not quite accurate, because after the 14 and 11 election, there were already cabinet committees set up. After the 08 election, you must remember that election was held much later than what the previous election that we just held was held. So the 17 election was held in September. I think from memory, the 08 election was held in November. So we hadn't have as much time to get processes in place. I think everyone accepts it takes the government time to get up and running. But I think the public also expect that if a government is going to put in place laws and implement policies, that they do so in a way where they get good quality advice, they understand the implications, they understand the impact it's going to have on the lives of average New Zealanders, and the one or two pager that they put together for an election campaign is not sufficient if you're putting in place a policy that impacts on real people.
So we'll move on to the East Asia Summit that's occurring in Manila at the moment. So obviously the TPP is sort of Labor's first stage, I suppose, to kind of show New Zealand and the world sort of maybe what international relationships will have as a country. But what is National sort of hoping that will be the result of these talks?
Well, we're hoping that TPP gets across the line. Todd McClay, our previous trade minister, was putting in a huge amount of time on working with other countries under the TPP 11 framework after Donald Trump decided to pull the United States out of TPP. He was putting in a huge amount of travel and effort to work with other countries to come up with a solution which would still work for New Zealand and work for those other 11 nations. The bottom line is we're a nation at the bottom of the Pacific that needs to trade with the rest of the world. TPP opens up a huge number of doors for us to walk through, which will assist our exporters. Labor opposed it when it was before the Parliament a year or two ago. It seems that they're much more open-minded to free trade, and we welcome that. Free trade is important for the country. There's a few areas that the Labor Party has a different point of view from the National Party on. I think the one which is probably the sticking point for the Labor Party is what's called investor-state dispute settlement clauses. Mm. Effectively, that means there's a regime put in place where if a foreign government acts against investors or decides to legislate to take away investor rights, there's the ability for some challenge there. There's also, however, written into the old TPP agreement, the ability for governments still to legislate for social well-being, for environmental well-being. So those ISDS clauses wouldn't apply where a government is legislating for the social or environmental benefit of a country.
But regardless of the social environmental aspect of it, just in general, don't you think sort of putting that control or you know, possibility of control and being able to sue in kind of corporate interest hands just undermines, you know, like a government's sovereignty in general?
No, because investors need to have confidence when they're investing in a country that they're not going to have rogue governments go and expropriate assets. And New Zealand has never been challenged under ISDS. We have always had good quality government that makes reasonable laws, with cabinet committees in place, I guess you could say. And we've never been challenged under ISDS. When Labor did the China Free Trade Agreement, they were happy for these clauses to be in there. They had a change of heart while they were in opposition, but it's very normal, and it actually protects New Zealand investors as well. So if you have New Zealand companies that are investing in parts of Asia, which may not have the same type of democratic systems that New Zealand does, they need to have confidence that if they're investing, they're not going to have the government of those countries go along and just rip out assets from beneath them. Where we've seen those ISDS clauses used in other countries, it's typically been in countries that aren't as democratic as we would expect, where countries have literally gone and said overnight that, you know, hundreds or billions of dollars worth of assets that is owned by a company where they've invested in this country, we're now taking that off you. Those are the only real cases where ISDS clauses have been used successfully. Most ISDS cases fail, and most countries that have good quality government like New Zealand do not get challenged and are not losing under the system. New Zealand's never been challenged. We have good quality government, and it actually benefits New Zealanders more than anything else.
What about somebody like Australia that was challenged in terms of the plan packaging for tobacco, and then they ended up having to pay you know, millions in sort of settlement money. Like, would that, is that something that could possibly happen to New Zealand?
That wasn't done under ISDS clauses. That was done under a whole
other same sort of. It's that same sort of idea that, that corporate control can undermine the government.
It's not corporate control. It gives investors some certainty that they're not going to have their assets taken away, and that good quality government is going to exist. But in any case, if you want to look at that plain packaging and you want to look at health benefits, under TPP that we negotiated, there was the ability, written in there specifically, for a future New Zealand government to make legislation for the health benefits of the country if it wanted to. There were exceptions put in there. The only types of things that the ISDS clauses would cover would be if a future New Zealand government went rogue and said, hey, all of your investment in this particular infrastructure, you no longer own it, we're taking it off you. Mm. New Zealand would never do that. We're a reasonable country. We have good democratic systems in place. It would benefit New Zealand investors investing in less democratic countries overseas. We've never been challenged before. We have these in place already in free trade agreements that the Labour Party has negotiated themselves. It's a relatively simple and normal part of trade agreements.
So we were speaking with a sort of TPP critic a little bit earlier on who says that if we agree to this agreement now, and that kind of puts these handcuffs on future governments in terms of economic sanctions later on, and can undermine their autonomy and just sort of undermines democracy in general, because we've got so many different countries that have, you know, changing democracies, changing governments every few years. Is that something that, you know, we should be worried about as a country in terms of future governments?
Kelly, I think the risk we have here is that a very small part of the trade agreement, which has never been used in New Zealand, that actually benefits New Zealanders in other countries, in a situation where we still have the ability to legislate in New Zealand's best interest. I think we're at risk of having a very important, very beneficial trade agreement derailed by something which is so discreet, never been used before, and would not hurt us at all. We're at risk of that, and it wouldn't be good. Just remember, TPP covers a third of the world's GDP. Before the United States was taken out, it was expected that it would benefit New Zealand by $2.7 billion. That will have dropped a little bit now that the United States is out of it, but it's still going to be hugely beneficial to New Zealand. We rely on trade agreements. We can't let a certain clause in a trade agreement that has never hurt us before in previous agreements that we have ISDS in, we can't let that derail something so important for New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that the Labour Party is now having a bit of a rethink and an about-face on that particular part of TPP. I think if you read between the lines, you can see Jacinda Ardern's now starting to walk back the comments they've previously made about ISDS, because they've now had the official advice. They've now had their trade negotiators in front of them, reminding them just how important TPP is for New Zealand. So I hope for the benefit of our country and our exporters and New Zealanders that want to see the country grow, that Labour does do well and gets TPP across the line with the other 11 countries over the next few days. It's in our national interest, and the National Party supports TPP and supports Labour trying to get it across the line.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Jamie Lee, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Kelly. Take care.
That was the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
The Wire.
Help the aged. One time they were just like you. Drinking, smoking, sex and sniffing glue. Help the aged. Forget that nothing lasts forever. No big.
and it's such a lonely place. In the meantime, we try, try to forget that nothing lasts forever. No big deal, so give us all that feel. Fighting though, all falls away. When did you first realize it's time you took an older lover, baby? He keeps your stuff, although he's looking rough. Fighting though, all falls away. Can die your hair, but it's the one thing you can't change. Can't run away from yourself.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Today, a protest began in the viaduct where transport workers expressed disdain over the changes Auckland Transport has made to the industry. The changes have resulted in reduced hours and job losses to those working within the sector. I spoke with Rail and Maritime Transport Union spokesperson John Kerr, asking him to explain the petition.
Our members who work on the trains in Auckland, and the members of First Union and the Tramways Union who work on the buses are presenting a couple of petitions to Auckland Transport, and they're about safety.
Mm. So can you go into a bit more detail on the different kinds of petitions that are being handed in?
Yeah, sure. So I can speak more about the rail one. First, I'll have a comment on the bus drivers. So the rail crews are very, very concerned at Auckland Transport's plan to take permanent onboard crews off the trains. In our view, this would severely compromise public safety, and our members are opposed to this. They've gone out to the public and asked for support, and we've had thousands of people sign the petition in under a week, backing our stance.
And so how does having a physical person there add to safety?
So most of us would think of a member of the train crew as the guard or the conductor. And they're the first responder in the event of a medical emergency or a safety critical trackside incident or something of that nature. It's their job to make sure that disabled passengers have access and egress on the train. It's their job to act as a deterrent to antisocial behaviour and to protect vulnerable travellers, such as the elderly or women travelling alone at night. And they have a plethora of skills around safety critical incidents. For example, in the event of a level crossing incident, if there's a need to evacuate passengers and so forth. We believe that taking those people off the trains would be ripping up the safety culture and is asking for trouble.
Mm. And why do you think government has implemented these changes?
So, I mean, we believe that Autumn Transport, which is the bureaucrats who run the rail, ferry, and bus network, we think that they're driven by stripping cost out of the system. We think this is a classic case of putting profit before people, and in doing so, compromising public safety. The Mayor of Auckland, Phil Gough, has said that one of his priorities is to have a reliable and efficient transport network. We're sure that he would agree with us that we should also have a safe transport network.
Mm. And so the increase in technological involvement, obviously that's becoming more prominent. And I mean, the implications of that are that our transport sector might not have people involved anymore. Why do you think that's a bad thing?
I agree with you. I think one of the reasons why we're facing this challenge is because there is technology that gives the impression that the driver can operate the doors and can see what's going on in the carriage. And ultimately, the technology will be such that one day we'll be fighting over driverless trains. Our argument is that it's people who travel on the trains. And it's people who have needs, and it's other people who best meet those needs. I wouldn't want to be on a train with up to 600 other people when there was an incident, and the only safety-critical member of staff on that train was the driver who for very good reasons, locked in their cab.
That was all my questions. Do you have any further comments you wanted to make?
I think the only comment I would like to make is that for our members, this is about safety. We don't want to inconvenience the public, but we won't compromise on safety.
So around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
How are you today, Nicole?
I'm well, thank you, Kelly. How are you?
Good. So what's happening in Australia right now, because New Zealand is, we've got lots of news. What about Australia?
Yeah, I've been seeing interesting New Zealand news again. I mean, obviously since the election, there's been a lot of news.
There's been a lot of news, yes. Indeed. That's exciting that it makes it across the ditch.
Yeah, it's good. I feel like maybe you guys hear more about Australia than we hear about you normally. I'm not sure.
Well, you are a lot bigger, so that would make sense.
And we have a lot of unsettling stories lately. This week, Sam Dastyari, who's a popular Labor senator.
Yes.
I think we may have talked about him before, but he's quite outspoken about white nationalism and things like that because he's a non-practicing Muslim. He's the first Iranian member of parliament in Australia.
Mm.
And he just went out for a meal at the pub the other night and he was confronted by members of the Nationalist Patriot Blue group.
Mm.
And the video is online. It's gotten a lot of attention. Not many likes, though, which is, interesting. Mm. And they said things like, you're a terrorist.
Horrible.
Go back to Iran, all those classic national.
Yeah, derogatory, yep.
Yeah. And Sam Dastyari has basically said that he receives stuff like this all the time. It's just this one was filmed, really.
Yeah.
And he said that I think when Australia was watching the US election from afar, there was sort of an attitude of we're superior to them and we don't have this kind of stuff here. But Sam Dastyari is pointing out that surprisingly common. He gets stuff like this all the time.
Right.
And maybe if we had non-compulsory voting, we could have had a very different situation.
Yeah, exactly right. So what sort of reaction is this getting from the public? Is there a lot of people that are, wanting to see something done about this?
I think in general, people are on Sam Dastyari's side. But at the same time, you read the comments on articles about it and people are saying, well, maybe they took it a bit too far, but they have a point and things like that, which is, quite concerning, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, Pauline Hanson has said he just wants attention. I don't know why you would go about getting attention this way.
Absolutely. So I've also seen that one of Malcolm Turnbull's key lieutenants has rounded on conservative colleagues and cooking up an alternative same-sex marriage bill, saying those who fought against it should not be in charge of legislating.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. It seems as if the coalition are seeing that maybe this vote will actually turn out as a yes, and now they're thinking, oh, we need to create an alternative bill. So it's more than a dozen members of the coalition, and they're saying that this bill that they want to pass, if there is a yes vote, or to vote on a bill, that it will have stricter religious protections than the law that was initially proposed to pass through the parliament and the one that the Prime Minister supports. So basically the one that the Prime Minister supports so it says, yes, you can have same-sex marriage, but churches and specific religious institutions can refuse to marry same-sex couples.
Right.
And that's already quite a strong religious protection. But there's not many details about it, but they're saying that it will focus on the ceremony itself. So it's a little bit vague. They're saying it's just even stronger protection for religious bodies somehow.
That's just, they're not really giving up, are they? That keeps becoming more and more roadblocks for this to pass it. Yeah.
Yeah. They seem to be wanting, like, this is like damage control type stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If it, you know, if there's a yes vote, well, we've got this extra protection for our conservative, very conservative faction.
I also see the Victorian Disability Minister has urgently intervened to remove a young man with a profound intellectual disability from jail.
Yeah, this is a big story that was on 7:30. So the National Disability Insurance Scheme essentially was viewed as a really great package. This young man, Francis, he's 20 years old, and he had been given a $1.5 million NDIS package.
Right.
But it turns out that because the market is meant to provide the care, they said that there was no one available for him and there's no system in place for last resort providers.
Yeah, so they put him in prison.
Yep, if you need 24/7 care and there's no one available at the time, you could end up in prison like this young man has. And there was a sort of an expose of sorts about the inability of the NDIS to look after him. You know, he was in apparently a bloody shirt. He'd been self-harming, hadn't changed for days.
Yeah.
It's really horrible. Like, and his mental capacity is of a young child.
That's horrible. Do you think there'll be some sort of, you know, if this had gone so unnoticed, will there be some sort of investigation now into potentially other cases?
I think so, yes. His lawyer was from Victorian Legal Aid, and they said that they know of, I mean, they actually have clients who are in the same situation and they know of more cases. So hopefully they get the attention that they deserve. And it seems like a lot of red tape has been the problem here. There's a lot of government agencies involved and, like, who takes responsibility? And,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you need safeguards in place.
Awesome. Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us, Nicole. We really appreciate it. And hopefully maybe some more happy news next week.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Awesome. Have a lovely week.
You too.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch. And I've just been given a breaking news piece of paper. 30 more tickets are available for Marlon Williams, which is sold out in Point Chef RSA show tonight. So there's 30 more tickets left available now from Ticketmaster. So go there right now. Get your tickets. 30 more tickets left. But that was about 5 minutes ago, guys. That could mean there's 5 tickets left. So if I was you, I'd go to Ticketmaster right now and get myself a ticket. Next up, we have an interview about Recycling Week. So stay tuned. 5395 is the number to text. I've had a couple of texts and I'll be reading some more out after this song.
Yeah. Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Recycling Week is coming to a close over the weekend. It's an event which tries to promote recycling amongst New Zealanders. I talked with the sustainability manager for Claim, Peter Ralph, asking about the events that have occurred over the week.
Mainly it's just been pushed out internally through schools and businesses, you know, via daily messages, whether that's kind of email or on the internet. Events-wise, it's really up to each individual, you know, school or business, to kind of take the resources from Recycling Week and use it how you can. I've seen some pictures come through of, you know, passionate people taking their all of their reusable goods, for instance, on Reusable Wednesday, and making a little stall in their lunchroom, and, you know, they've got their reusable coffee cups, their reusable drink bottles, their beeswax wrap to replace Glad wrap, that sort of thing.
And how successful do you think this has been this year in comparison to previous years?
Yeah, I mean, Recycling Week's been steadily growing and growing. This year we've probably doubled the participants. You know, we're getting a lot more engagement online, and especially through the online quizzes. It's definitely something that more and more people are becoming aware of, and it's a growing thing for sure.
Mm. Do you think this is a reflection, because statistics from earlier this year were that our waste is increasing by 13%, do you think this is a reflection of, like, how important it is to recycle?
Yeah, I think waste in general is certainly becoming more, people are paying more attention to it. Especially when you've got stats like that, you know, more waste is being produced. So, yeah, I think the general awareness is certainly catching on, which is a great thing. Now we really need people to start actually doing something about it. And I think Recycling Week is certainly helping with that.
Mm. And now that China has decided to stop taking on our waste, how is that going to change recycling for New Zealand?
Yeah, that's a very good point. It certainly is making... It's certainly causing some changes in the recycling industry. At the moment, to be honest, it's a little bit wait and see. What I imagine will happen is that, unfortunately, it probably will start to cost a little bit more to recycle. But in the long term, I think it's a good thing because it could potentially act as a catalyst for countries across the world to do more of their own recycling and take care of their own waste rather than sending it overseas.
Mm. And so you're saying that it might increase the cost of recycling, so that would come in a taxpayer increase, you believe?
Yes, potentially that could happen. Like I said, it's all a little bit kind of up in the air at the moment, but that is one of the potential implications, yeah.
Mm. And so Countdown has made the goal to phase out plastic bags by 2018, I believe it was. What other kind of practices do you think could be implemented in order to reduce our waste?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great one, and I think foodstuffs are doing a similar thing as well. Really, it's just, I mean, there's what we talk about as the waste hierarchy. So ideally, you want to reduce what you're purchasing in the first place, and only, you know, buy what you need and what you do buy, make sure it's of good quality, so it's actually going to last a while and you're not throwing it out. Then you want to try to reuse anything that you can. And then you want to make sure that what you are buying has an end-of-life solution. You know, is it compostable? Is it recyclable? Those are some good tips. And really, it's once you start just kind of thinking about things in terms of their whole life cycle, it's amazing how much you can really reduce the amount that you're throwing away to landfill.
What other practices can people just on a personal level use to reduce their waste? Like you mentioned before, using beeswax paper.
Those reusable items are a great place to start. Just buy a reusable coffee cup, for instance. You know, I do a fair amount of waste audits, and disposable coffee cups is something that we always find a lot of. So that's a great place to start. Just drink bottles, for instance. Those beeswax things are great. Reusable Tupperware as well. All of those kind of little things certainly add up.
You just said you did waste audits. What does that kind of look like?
So that is literally when we go through, you know, a business or a school or some organisation's waste for a certain time period. And we simply pick out all of the recyclable items that are in there. And then, we provide, you know, we let the people know, hey, look, actually what was in your waste that was going to landfill, 75% of it or a number like that was actually recyclable. And it's amazing what you find. It's often around that number. You know, there really is a huge opportunity for everybody to reduce the amount of waste that they're sending to landfill.
Perfect. Did you have any further comments you wanted to make?
I'd just like to encourage everybody to you know, think twice about what they're throwing away. Think about the whole life cycle of anything that they're buying. Jump online, recycle.co.nz, to find out more. And yeah, everybody's individual actions definitely makes a difference.
Hey, what's your name? Got a diary?
Good Times Radio on BFM. Guaranteed to cure hangovers, improve disposition, make you young again, and turn winter to spring. Well, pretty much. Good Times Radio with Samuel Harmony, only on 95 BFM. Brighten up your weekend every Saturday morning, 9 to 11. Everybody have a good time
right now. That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Friday, the 10th of November. Kia ora rawa atu. Thank you to everybody listening and for everybody for texting. And I'm sorry I didn't have time to read them, but I did read them and we all chatted about them here. So thank you for those. Thank you to everybody who came on the show today, including Jamie Lee Ross, Nicole Wedding, Peter Ralph, John Kerr, and Jane Kelsey. Also, a huge thank you to my producers, Laura and Connor. Guys, that was a good show. Well done.
Solid.
Solid show. We got some news, guys. We ate a lot of hummus, didn't we?
We did.
I'm full of hummus.
I'm full of hummus. So I'm full of good hummus. Next week, the journey will return and we will chat about it. We'll make sure we have time. Murray's up next with Land of the Good Groove. Have a lovely week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.